There are going to be quite a few new faces in Congress after November. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It wasn't just House Speaker Paul Ryan who announced that he wouldn't be running for re-election. Numerous members of Congress in Florida are stepping away on both sides of the aisle. We're going to look at the key races and what voters may do come November. This year marks the 90th anniversary of the Tamiami Trail. It was considered an engineering feat, but it's also been an ecological disaster. We're going to talk with the creator of an exhibit that tries to encapsulate the history of that road. And finally, New World Symphony has a performance this weekend, and it's going to stream it live. How technology is bringing the orchestra worldwide. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this year is the 90th anniversary of a marvel of engineering and a very controversial project built by humans. We're talking about the Tamiami Trail. It was 1928 when private builders, along with the Army Corps of Engineers, finished constructing the 113-mile road across the Everglades from Miami to Naples. It wasn't just about building a road across the state. There were developers who wanted to basically drain the Everglades. They were thinking communities all across the area. And that's where the controversy sits. The road now acts as a dam, and the Army Corps of Engineers are working to raise it so that water can flow back through again into the Everglades. Our next guest is Jonathan Ullman from the Sierra Club, Florida, and he created an exhibit called Trailblazers. It's on display now at the Collier County Museum in Naples. It was here in Coral Gables, actually, not too long ago. Jonathan, a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Louis, thank you very much. Honored to be on your show.
All right, you know what? When's the last time, by the way, that you drove over that road?
Last month? Yeah.
All right, so, I mean, when you go over that road, knowing its history, knowing everything that you've done in your exhibit, bringing attention to, you know, its history and the controversy, I mean, what do you think about when you're driving over it?
Well, it's bittersweet because I know the environmental damage that occurred as a result of it, but it's also a beautiful drive. I mean, it's fantastic. If you're going to go across the Everglades, you might as well take Tamiami Trail if you have the time. That's what I always say.
There are numerous Floridians who've taken that road and a lot who haven't. Sometimes they take the other bigger road across the way, Alligator Alley. But how would you describe it? As you said, it is a beautiful drive.
Well, first when you cross Chrome Avenue, you go in through the stretch of Shark River Slough, which is a vast sawgrass prairie. And it's all flat, and you see tree islands. And up until recently, you haven't actually been able to see the Everglades because there's a levee on one side, and then there was a Brazilian pepper on the other side to the south. But now with this 1 mile bridge, you can actually see to the south the Everglades, and it's pretty phenomenal. But then as you get towards the middle of the Everglades, it becomes the Big Cypress, and that is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you just have a completely different view. There's dense trees surrounding you, and you feel like you're in the forest. And then you get to Everglades City, which is a very interesting place. And then finally you hit the sprawl of Naples, which is beginning to look like Miami every single day.
It's been a while since I've been in Naples. I don't know if they've gotten that close, but I do know what you're saying. Your exhibit, Trailblazers, so it was at the Coral Gables Museum. Now it's in Collier County. What was the response like for that? Because, I mean, this exhibit is a collection of a lot of old photographs. You know, you have different mediums to tell this story, and you even had a display, I don't know if you still have that one display, really for kids, where they can see how water moves through different areas and how this road again has played a role as a dam. But I mean, what was the response so far?
It's had very good audience. When I was in Collier County, there were 200 people who came to see a presentation about the exhibit. There's a lot of interest, especially since it's the 90th anniversary of the completion of the road. So people want to know about the history, how this road came about, but also about what are the environmental impacts and what's being done to try to make it better.
So how did you come up with this idea for this exhibit? And really, when did you start getting interested in the Tamiami Trail?
Well, I was I work for the Sierra Club, the environmental organization, and I was working on Tamiami Trail, the issue of sending the water south through Shark River Slough, which is the main corridor of water into Everglades National Park. And in order to do that, you have to elevate the road. So we were advocating for an 11-mile bridge called, we called it the Everglades Skyway at the time. And so I had a PowerPoint presentation, and I would start to give the PowerPoint presentation to various groups in town. And I was very interested in the history. So I just started going back to the history of how the road was built, why, and it's sort of like it built upon itself.
And it wasn't just, I mean, the Army Corps of Engineer obviously played a big role in really everything that we see that's changed with the Everglades from north Lake Okeechobee all the way down south. But there were some big players involved in the Tamiami Trail for money reasons, really. Let's talk about who they were.
Okay, well, the Tamiami Trail was really a land deal. Two blocks from our studio is the Miami City Cemetery, where you see the tombstone of James Franklin Jodan. And underneath it, it says, the father of Tamiami Trail. He was the person who came up with the plan, along with business representatives from Tampa and Fort Myers, to build a road, Tamiami, Tampa to Miami, across the Everglades. Actually, it was originally supposed to be Tamiami with a Y. That was for the Fort Myers part, but they got rid of that. Anyway, he bought land in the middle of the Everglades, a huge portion of land under a company called the Chevalier Corporation, which he planned on then converting into whatever, housing developments, sugar plantations, drilling. He didn't care as long as he could develop that land, but he needed a road to get from Miami to that land. And so that's what began the Tamiami Trail. He was the Dade County tax assessor. This is in 1915 when he embarked upon this project. He was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, and he would give these speeches around town and get people interested so that he could develop this land. The problem was it was a very tough project to build a road through the middle of the Everglades.
And then there was another gentleman who got involved, Baron Collier, which is what Collier County was named after him. Big money guy. He came into the picture when?
He came into the picture about 1926. The Tamiami Trail had stalled. The portion from Tampa to Fort Myers was completed. The portion from Miami to the middle of the Everglades to Joe Don's property, which he wanted to develop, was done. But that last piece was missing, and there was no money. So Collier, who had much more money than Joe Don, I mean, he was truly a huge business force. He bought up all of Southwest Florida, and then he made a deal with the governor, and he said, I will finish the trail, but I want my own county. It was part of Lee County at the time. I want my own county, and I'm going to build my county seat called Everglades City, and it's going to be bigger than Miami. And that was the plan, and that's what he did, and it got done. But history didn't turn out exactly the way it planned.
And then, of course, that's how then the road was basically connected in a very strange way between both coasts because of these two men trying to force it, their way through it. And there is the one, I guess, not to say it's a misconnect, but where they battled it out, it came as the loop. And basically what I'm saying is that anybody who's been through a loop road there is like this other part of Tamiami Trail. And it was just because they both wanted to go their own way. They didn't want to connect together, but they had to.
Well, Jodan had linked to his land, but Collier said, I have other plans. And he went around Jodan's land, and that's why there are two different parts of the Tamiami Trail.
Something fascinating, too, about this project you had pointed out to me is there was this video. The Army Corps of Engineer, of course, led an information campaign about this its creation. And I wanted to listen to this, the beginning of this film called Waters of Destiny. It's a promotional video from the 1950s about the work that they were doing in the Everglades.
Everything was lovely in Florida, so it seemed. The sun was kind, the surf was fresh, the beaches white and clean. To millions of Americans, it was Valhalla, the nation's playtime paradise, the place where all was right and nothing was wrong. Beautiful, carefree, the land that nature always smiled upon. So it seemed. But once you got past the surf and the shore, the glittering jewel face of the side hard by the sea, there was trouble. Nature was frowning. The trouble was water. Too much of it on one hand, not enough of it on the other. When the rains came, they inundated the flat lowlands of central and southern Florida, overfilling the inland waters, flooding the rich soils, destroying crops, turning hard-earned farm profits into devastating losses.
And again, that's a film from the 1950s produced by the Army Corps of Engineers called Waters of Destiny. And really, it's about how they came in and just changed all of the Everglades. It is strange to listen to today, so many decades later. But Jonathan Ullman, when you hear that, do you get the sense a Corps understood the long-term repercussions of what they were doing?
Absolutely. That's why they were brought in. In 1947, Everglades National Park was created, but in 1948, the CNSF project, the Central and South Florida project, was begun that would create modern South Florida. Ever before then, anything west of Miami International would be flooded in the summer. But after this project, they built the protective levee. They divided the Everglades into compartments. They blew, you can see the pictures of the Army generals coming in and blowing up things in the middle of the Everglades to build water control structures, levees, dams. It changed everything.
Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier I wanted to touch on briefly is, so there was an attempt to raise the road to allow the water to flow a little more naturally. That 11-mile stretch was not approved by Congress, but there were other smaller bits that were approved. So there was a 1-mile bridge that was built, and there's another bigger project still in the works, right?
That's right. The state of Florida and the National Park Service are building, in addition to the 1-mile bridge, which the Corps of Engineers built in 2013, there are now these other entities are now building a 2.6-mile bridge, and that is nearing completion, and that's near the Value Jet Memorial.
And is that enough? Is that going to, I mean, look, we're never going to be able to restore what we destroyed as human beings, but is that enough to at least get the waters flowing through a little bit better than before? I mean, is that going to make a big difference?
Every bit of bridging, every bit of decompartmentalization, tearing down levees within the central part of the Everglades, everything that can add more water flow, because Everglades gets half of its water from rain, but half of its water historically came from from north. So it needs more water flow.
All right. So that's talking about history. Let's move to something contemporary here, is the fact that And this may not be, you know, apples to oranges, but there's a similarity here. There's a contemporary issue facing the Everglades. There's a proposed expansion of State Road 836 past the urban boundary development line in Kendall. Has the Sierra Club taken a stance on this project?
Yes, we have. We've been opposed ever since it was proposed. I think 5 years ago the process began. We oppose it because we know why it's being built, and it's being built for sprawl developers, just like Frank Jodon tried to built a road to get to his property. This road is being built to allow developments outside the urban development boundary to have a highway next to them so that they can be developed.
And there's going to be a vote. Well, actually, there's going to be a meeting tomorrow to discuss plans.
We are told that the process will start tomorrow. And then on June 20th, there will be another hearing. And we strongly encourage everybody to call their county commissioners to attend the public hearing. If they can come tomorrow at 9:30, if they can go to the hearing on June 20th, this will increase traffic. It will add to the Dolphin and the Palmetto Expressway's traffic. Every time there has been a highway, whether it be the Palmetto Belt or the Turnpike Belt, traffic increases until there's a standstill.
And that's an issue that we're going to dive deeper into as well as that unfolds. But again, I've been talking with Jonathan Ullman from the Sierra Club, Florida, talking about it is the 90th anniversary of the Tamiami Trail. as he said, it is a beautiful drive. It is a beautiful road, but also very controversial in what it has done in basically reshaping the Everglades. Jonathan, such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Luis.
All right, still to come, Susan McManus will join us to talk Florida politics. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Florida has long been a key player in shaping our country's politics, and the 2018 midterm elections have launched the Sunshine State into the national spotlight again. Over the past year, a number of Republican members of Congress have announced plans for retirement. And just a few weeks ago, Governor Rick Scott, of course, launched his campaign against longtime Democratic Senator Bill Nelson. That's a race that could become the most expensive in the U.S. Longtime political analyst Dr. Susan McManus joins us now from the studios of the University of Southern Florida, where she's a professor of political science. Dr. McManus, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we've seen recently, say within the last few months, we've seen this wave of Republican congressmen drop out of races, or they're not going to run again, I should say. Have you ever seen this many people decide, I'm out?
Well, I haven't really counted up, but it certainly seems like a record this time out. And there's a lot of different reasons for it. Some people just get weary of it and want to come home. Some are planning to run for higher office, like Ron DeSantis wants to run for governor, has announced that he will. Others are just really frustrated with what's going on in Washington. And if you go up there and you really want to get something done, and pretty soon it looks like the wheels are spinning and you get penalized for trying to reach across the aisle to work out a compromise, you suddenly at some point say, you know what, I'm out of here. I'll go back home and I'll work in my community. And we've seen a couple of those kinds of resignations take place among Florida Republicans.
How much of it is that inability for Democrats and Republicans at times to reach across the aisle, as you said, and work together? And how much of it is everything that's going on in the White House?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. That's what makes this such a fascinating election. And all the years I've covered it, this has got to be one of the most fascinating election years, and not just because it's a midterm in general. The White House is one factor, the inability to work out compromises another, being penalized by your own party for wanting to vote differently on an issue that causes you to be crossways with people back home. The lack of civility. It is increasingly the case that anyone who does reach across the aisle is cast by the media as being weak and losing. And that, of course, makes leadership in each chamber, the House and the Senate, and each party threaten members if they don't toe the party line. And it's very frustrating to people. And I think a lot of these retiring Congress members, some will say it's because it's not a Republican year. There's a lot of it that's just simple weariness of the whole atmosphere in Washington.
All right, let's look at one of the latest ones. Representative Dennis Ross of Lakeland, that's the 15th district, which covers much of Hillsborough County in eastern Tampa. President Trump won the district by 10 points in 2016. Why is he out?
He is one of the ones who is regarded as more of a centrist. He served a couple terms up there. He's very hooked into the community, very interested in schools back home. And just frankly, as a family guy, just got tired of being away from his family. He's one that many of us who follow politics really believe he just got weary of it rather than resigning because of the thought that he might lose. It's a very interesting race because you do have, is also part of that district, you have some of Polk County, so it's a bleed between Polk County and Hillsborough County. And the candidates are kind of lining up that way. Some say it's already the Republican race to replace him is already a primary featuring one prominent Republican from Hillsborough County and another one from Polk County running against each other. But fascinating also is the fact that a young Democrat, Andrew Learned, is also doing pretty well at raising money. And some see that as a sign that maybe this district is a bit more competitive and maybe, sort of against odds, maybe the Democrats would pick this up if there truly is this massive differential in enthusiasm for voting that gives the edge to Democrats. A fascinating race in a very important part of the state because this is sort of one of those I-4 corridor districts that people are watching very carefully to see what impact the Trump campaign and his whole presidency is having on this kind of race
and
this part of the state.
And Ross's retirement announcement came the same day as Paul Ryan's. I mean, is that a reaction to a change in leadership or just coincidental?
One is always reticent to say anything is coincidental in Washington politics. But it does sort of look like this was more along that line. But maybe hearing about Ryan resigning was just the final straw to push Ross to make the same decision. We don't know. We do know from some of the news accounts that have come out that Ross was talking to some of his friends in the Republican Party in the area about not running again before the announcement was made.
And then there is Representative Tom Rooney. He dropped out of the reelection back in February, this days after the Parkland shooting. Why did he decide to call it quits?
I think he had other opportunities. I don't know exactly the details as much about that race as I do the other. You already see, though, when you have an open congressional seat, even though that's a very heavily Republican district, you really see a crowded field emerging pretty rapidly. And there are some well-known names in that race, too. You have, Democrats, two Democrats in the race so far. These are who have filed with the Division of Elections, and three Republicans, two of whom are pretty well-known, Greg Stube and Julio Gonzalez. But this is, if you're a Democrat and you've at least got candidates to run, you're thinking anything is possible in this kind of strange election year.
Yeah, do you?
But
do
this
you,
one looks like it's going to lean more Republican.
Yeah, but do you see that? Do you see the Democrats going into places where in the past they wouldn't have wasted time and the energy, that they feel they can flip some of these districts or maybe even all of them in Florida?
Definitely see that there's more energy there. And I hearken back to an opportunity that I was given right after the 2016 election, which was to speak to the Palm Beach County Democrats. And at the time, there were a number of people who were running to become the new state party chair, and they were almost every one of them promising that they would field more candidates, that they would put more emphasis on generating more excitement and more races at the local level, and particularly the state legislative and even the congressional. And then you see a record number so far of women candidates that are throwing their hat in the ring. So there's just a multiplicity of interesting dynamics that are going on this time out, much of it driven, again, by Washington politics, number one, and number two, by the Trump presidency, which is part of Washington politics. But the close election, and one of the things that you see historically is that when one candidate wins the presidency through the Electoral College, but another one wins the popular vote, that seems to be a shot of adrenaline in the arm of the party that won the popular but lost the Electoral College vote. And that's what we're seeing among Florida Democrats, and really a pattern we're seeing across the rest of the country.
All right, let's talk about Representative Ileana Ross-Layton. And a year ago this week, actually, she announced that she would be retiring a year ago this week. Let's talk about a little bit about her legacy as a Republican Cuban woman in the legislature.
Well, the first Hispanic elected to Congress and the first Cuban woman elected to Congress. There's a story about the Today Show that she was, called by Katie Couric, who was host at the time, and informed her that she was the first Latina to be elected. And Congresswoman Ross-Layton said, "Well, I don't think so." And Katie Couric says, "Oh, yes, we have very good researchers here at NBC." And she was. She was a true trailblazer. There's a wonderful story about how she got into politics, but it was a family affair, and her dad and mom worked in the campaign. And when she came from Cuba, she couldn't speak English, and she ultimately founded a school for helping new arrivals learn English. A wonderful story there. But no surprise that she was retiring. Hillary Clinton heavily carried that district, and Ross-Layton was definitely a little bit more centrist and even a little bit more liberal, particularly on social issues, than was the district where other Republicans in Florida.
All right, let's get to one of the other big races. As I mentioned, this is probably going to be one of the most expensive races in U.S. history. Of course, the nationally watched Senate race between incumbent Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott. Scott, of course, announced Scott's announcement did not come as any surprise because everybody had been waiting for it. How has he been gearing up for his campaign? What have you seen so far?
The governor has certainly been doing what pragmatic candidates that really know that these races are tight after all, you know, the last four elections, two gubernatorial and two presidential contests have only been decided by 1%. He's been taking advantage of his role of governor and been able to go all around to all kinds of places and cut ribbons and appear at events, getting local news coverage, free media, as we call it in the business, and certainly aware that Republicans need to have a high turnout in an election like this, and certainly not leaving any part of Florida unturned. And the same is true, by the way, of Senator Nelson. He has a history of doing that. If you look at where he goes and his in-person visits, not just in an election year, but throughout every year, it's almost like you just take a pencil and you mark as he's going around the state. These candidates are both seasoned candidates. They both understand the grassroots. They understand the importance of appearing locally and not just in an election year. I have called this the battle of the titans of experienced politicians who have both won a statewide race in Florida, but vastly different in their policy appeal and approaches.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Susan McManus, professor of political science at the University of Southern Florida and a longtime authority on the politics of the Sunshine State. A lot is going to change come November, considering a lot of people are not going to run for re-election or they're going for a different office. You know what, when we look at this race between the governor, Governor Scott, and Senator Nelson, what do you think are going to be the big issues? And I ask this because I've already started seeing in all places, watching television shows on Hulu, Governor Scott's ads. And the ads that have been popping up are about his fight against for term limits. But what do you think are going to be the issues that each of these candidates are going to have to lean on most?
Well, we'll look at Nelson first. He is certainly going to be on the attack of the governor's records. That's one of the things when you're the chief executive of the state and you have to sign a lot of legislation, you are, in a way, vulnerable to any kind of criticism regarding your record. And so right now you see that Nelson is primarily, his approach thus far is to attack the governor's record on such things as that nursing home situation at the end of the Hurricane Irma, the governor's failure to take Medicaid expansion and highway funds for rapid transit, and other things like his record on the felon voting rights and also attacking Scott's A-plus rating as from the NRA. On the other hand, Scott is definitely going to run again on his jobs record, which even fact checkers have found that his claim that he would create 700,000 jobs during his 8-year tenure as governor has been fairly substantiated, as has the low unemployment rate. But he is really trying to go after a lot of grassroots people to get them out to vote, Republicans especially, but not just them, because congressional term limits have long been a very popular thing. In fact, if you look at polling in general, the one issue that people consistently have the highest positive ratings for in the 70-80 percentile range is the idea of term limits. Americans and Floridians are no exception here, really like them. And he, of course, is going to attack Nelson for how long he's been in office and some things like that. Both of them are aggressively trying to get the new Puerto Rican vote. They realize that that's important to the future of each of their parties. But one of the things that's so interesting about this race, and let me tell you, there's going to be no shortage of money. More money is going to be pouring into this race outside of Florida than in. It has national consequences because it has to do with who controls the U.S. Senate. But one advantage that these candidates have in a way is that they do not have a serious primary such as we see in the governor's race, which lets them now focus all their attention between now and November on just this race. But it also means that they have to be very careful of never forgetting the 27 to 28% of Floridians who are not registered Democrat or Republican. And you can't stray too far to the ideological extremes of your party and expect to come back and energize and pull over just enough of these NPAs to push you to victory. So it's very unusual in that sense. I'm sure they're grateful that they don't have a primary, but they're also can't just appeal to their party at the same time that they know that turnout, particularly for Democrats, is often a bigger challenge in a midterm than it is for Republicans. Fascinating race.
And what do you think the role of, because you talk about the national implications of this race, what role does the president play? We've talked about this before. Do you see President Trump getting involved in any of the races, but especially this one?
At a minimum, indirectly involved, because there's no way around it. Obviously, it's Washington. It's a federal job. What's happening in the Congress or what's not happening and what the president is doing or not doing is going to be an integral part of the campaigns of each of these candidates. And even if not by them individually, meaning Scott individually or Nelson individually, by PACs and by interest groups and advocacy groups and adversarial groups who are going to be running ads either for or against them, depending on their leaning.
Well, I want to change things up a little bit with you. You announced this year, back in January, I think it was, that you would be retiring from your post as professor of political science at USF. But you've been such a critical voice in, you know, wading through all the political complex conversations this state has had. And so for that, by the way, thank you. But why the departure at such an exciting time? Why now?
Exactly because it is such an exciting time. And put things in perspective, I've been teaching at the college level for 47 years, the past 30 years at the University of South Florida, watched the whole state emerge into the nation's most competitive swing state, most interesting politically. But it's also true that I'm very aware of the fact that if older professors don't at some point say, okay, I'm going to retire officially from the classroom, I'm still going to continue to do all the political analysis this whole year, you can be sure. But at some point, you've got to open up space for all the new young PhDs who want to also go into college teaching. And that was one of the motivations, a great time to step aside and let a younger person, you know, have a position in my department, at the same time free me up to do much, much more of the political analysis of this wonderful election. So I am going to be heavily involved in continuing to do analysis from now till after the election, I can assure you.
Well, whoever that young PhD is coming in, big shoes to fill, but you have earned it, no doubt. What are some of your favorite, when you look back, what are some of your favorite campaigns that you followed over the years?
Oh, I think back on them, and of course, how can you say anything but the 2000 election? I went 36 hours without sleep that night because I had just gone home. I was TV analyst for the NBC affiliate here in Tampa at the time, and I just went home to get a few hours before going back to the morning shows really early, and I laid my head on the pillow, and the phone rang. And it was a Japanese reporter who, I guess, didn't care about the time differential. And I'll never forget, he says, "What's happening in Florida?" And then, of course, we had another 30-some days after that. I remember going over to my parents' house, so they lived near me, and my dad coming to the door. I hadn't been able to spend a lot of time, and he took one look at me, and he told me that I just didn't really look that good. And I said, "Daddy, I've just really not had a lot of sleep in the last 36 days or whatever." Fascinating. Some of the other wonderful experiences I've had, I was in the U.S. Supreme Court the day that Ruth Bader Ginsburg went on the bench, and I had the time and been involved in some redistricting cases, not in Florida, but some elsewhere, and to hear those cases argued, and it's such a monumental day. And I remember covering the Reagan funeral and Lawton Child's funeral, a very different kind of experience. But throughout all of this, the most wonderful part of all of it, and I've had just a career to really die for, is to be able to bring these experiences back to my students. And I love to take pictures and just to show them all the things and talk about what went on and excite them and challenge them to, you know, offer themselves for community service and public service
and they're gonna
elective service. It's been wonderful.
They're going to miss that. But we're going to have you back because we got a lot of time before November and a lot to talk about. I really appreciate the time, Dr. McManus. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Again, that's Dr. Susan McManus, professor of political science at the University of South Florida. Again, a longtime authority on the politics of the Sunshine State. She joins us from the studio at the University of Southern Florida. And coming up next on the program, we're going to be talking about the New World Symphony. They got a show coming up, but also how technology is bringing the orchestra to a lot more people. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And that's the New World Symphony performing Franz Schubert's Symphony No. 9 last spring. Now imagine as a high schooler being chosen to perform at a concert with these world-renowned classical musicians. 18-year-old French horn player Brianna Garcon at the Dillard School for the Arts in Fort Lauderdale has been working with the New World Symphony for months ahead of their concert this Saturday. Gabrielle Isquisace. You know what, Gabrielle? You told me a second ago, and I knew I was going to do this.
Isquisace.
Thank you. He's a bassoonist. He's from Sao Paulo, Brazil. He was selected to take part in this concert through a video audition. And then, of course, Canadian Darren Hicks, also a bassoonist, is now in his third year as a fellow at the New World Symphony. The side-by-side concert, by the way, features international connections through technology. The concert will be live-streamed and broadcast in the Soundscape Park. Brianna, Gabrielle, Darren, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
All right. So you know what? I'm curious as to when people start playing their instrument and how. What launches that? Sometimes it's by accident. Sometimes it's something that's planned out. But let me go around the table. I want to get a sense from all of you. Brianna, you told me you started playing the saxophone first, right?
Yes, I did start playing saxophone.
Okay, so why the switch to French horn? By the way, not to say French horn is beautiful. I do want to say
thank
that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. I also sang, and the French horn is a very hard instrument, and you need to know all your pitches beforehand to get the right partials and everything. So my band director needed French horn players my seventh grade year, and I was up for the challenge, and I still am.
Do you still play saxophone now?
I stopped playing this year because I really wanted to take French horn seriously for the rest of my life.
Oh, okay. Was it a hard switchover? I mean, they're very different instruments.
Yeah, it's very different because you're going from a woodwind to a brass instrument, and the main difference is just buzzing. And when you play your saxophone, you're playing on a reed, so it kind of messes that. The embouchure gets messed up. But ever since I stopped, it's just been a lot easier to play.
All right. Gabrielle, what about you? Have you been playing the same instrument your whole life? Or how many instruments do you play?
No, I started with flute, transverse flute. And I play until I was 14. When I start to study viola, and I play viola.
Oh, okay, all right. Who got you into it? Was it a family member, or was it just something in you?
Yeah, I started because my father plays saxophone, and he said to me, Gabriel, you need to play flute. And when I was 14, I listened to viola, and I love it. And father, sorry me. Oh. I will play the viola, and then I'm standing and playing the viola.
Oh, my goodness. All right, and Darren, what about you?
Well, I've been playing the longest, the oldest one in the room. I started when I was 12 playing the bassoon. I started in my band program. My band teacher, for whatever reason, had four bassoonists in the band in this tiny little farming town. And when I started, I was 6 feet tall. It's a pretty big guy, so, you know, he gave me a big instrument.
All right. I remember when I did try out for band in middle school, they gave me the trombone. And they said something about, well, your mouth fits that mouthpiece better. I didn't want to play the trombone. Nothing against the trombone. It's okay. You know what? I was curious. Brianna, let me come back to you and ask you. When you auditioned for this, what was that like? For this opportunity, I should say.
So this would, when I auditioned for Side by Side, I had to send in a pre-screening recording of me playing a solo. And I only knew one solo, so I just played that one. And when I did the audition, we had an orchestral excerpt. I've never played in an orchestra besides All-State Orchestra, and that's just like a one-time thing. And so I wasn't really thinking much about it. I was just like, oh, it's just going to be another band rehearsal, just with MTT, no big deal. But when I experienced playing with all the fellows and with all the young, very, very talented students, it was just eye-opening, and I'm very thankful for the experience.
Yeah, Darren, you know what? I was curious, I mean, because you played in a number of orchestras in Canada and elsewhere, but, you know, she talks about that experience of playing for the first time really with an orchestra. And, you know, how long do you go just kind of as a soloist or doing your own thing, and then all of a sudden you're working in an orchestra, and that's got to be kind of jarring?
It's definitely jarring. I mean, you go from playing by yourself in a practice room to playing with 85 other people on stage, and you're supposed to play together at the same time, the same music. You know, it can be quite an experience. It can be quite overwhelming for a lot of young kids when they first play in an orchestra. But it nothing can beat it, really. I mean, playing by yourself is great, but wouldn't you rather want to play with 100 people and make beautiful music together? It's amazing.
What's that like? What's that process like when you're all coming together? I mean, because if one person's off a little bit,
you know it. It's a lot of fun. The students who come into the Side by Side program are very well prepared, and the fellows, we do a lot of preparation with them before the week happens, because we don't have a lot of time to rehearse because they're all in high school and we're sort of coming to the end of our season, so we're working towards our last concert. So having that extra time earlier in the season to work with them on the parts and making sure that they know, okay, this is what's really important here, is that you're with the violin section if you're playing a solo in the French horn section, say. So giving them those tips that we've learned over the years and sort of helping them bridge that gap between, maybe for some of them it might be the first time playing with this sort of level of orchestra. So we just try to help them be as prepared as they can be so that the shock is a little dampened. Yeah.
Gabrielle, it is correct that you you were selected to take part in this concert through a video audition?
Yeah.
Is that typical these days? Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly.
What is that like?
You record by yourself or with a cameraman, and you're playing, and then you post on YouTube, and you just send to the
wait, you just post your audition on YouTube?
Exactly.
And that's how it works. It's just basically people are watching you on YouTube.
Exactly.
You know what? I mean, what was the response? I mean, did they get back, when they got back to you, what was it like for you when you found out that you were going to have this opportunity?
Was really, really, really incredible. I'm really proud to play with these amazing guys. It will be incredible.
I'm curious as to, is there a difference in when you're performing back home in Brazil? Is there a difference in the way that, you know, conductors and orchestras and musicians approach the music in Brazil compared to what you see how they do it here in the United States?
I think here the classical training is more organized, and the structure work best.
It's more structured?
I think.
And Darren, I mean, you were shaking your head. Having performed in Canada, but is there some, you see a difference when you're going from country to country?
Absolutely, yeah. I've worked in other countries, in Brazil as well, and there's a history in North America of conservatories and sort of training people to do this career, and it's just not quite there yet in other countries. They're trying to start programs like we are, but it's a question of having the history already in place and not having enough funds or available spaces to do it in, which we have an abundance of here in the States. So it's really great that we get to bring people in who are passionate about their music and give them more structure so they can be that much more successful in their lives.
There have been dramatic representations of intense relationships between maestro and performer, from shows like Mozart in the Jungle to the film Whiplash. I'm just curious as to, you know, what that relationship is like between the conductor and the performer. And again, it's many performers. But you know what, Brianna, let me start with you, because again, this is kind of a new experience for you. How do you describe that? What's that been like for you?
The very first time I had a really deep connection with the maestro, I would have to say, was with MTT at Side by Side last year. I was playing principal on almost every single song, and we were doing very hard pieces, and I had many, many solos, and we had this one Walton Viola Concerto, and we had a student conductor leading it, and I just was very, my confidence wasn't there, and I was playing all the right notes, and MTT was like, you need to do this, you need to do more of this, and
by the way, my MTT is
Michael Tilson Thomas.
Okay. You know, people may not know, they don't call him MTT.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry. That's all right.
Yeah. And one time I came late to rehearsal, and he specifically requested me to come and apologize, and I was so frightened, and I had to go to his dressing room, and I was so afraid, and I was like crying, and he was like, he told me a story of a time he was late to a concert and completely missed his whole solo. And he told me, his maestro told him that he's played this piece many times without the piano soloist, and because of him not being there, he realized that he needs the solo there and that you should always be early to every rehearsal. And he just went on a whole rant, and like he told me his whole life story because I was late, and it just showed me how much he actually cared about the students and everybody participating, and that he actually cared about me, and it was just very special.
All I know is this, when I get MTT in this studio, I'm gonna remind him of that story. That's a good story. You know what, Darren, for you as mm-hmm. well, I mean, is it anything like what we see portrayed, you know, in any of the films or shows?
I mean, Mozart in the Jungle is an extreme example. I think there have been in history conductors who are sort of that maniacal about leading the orchestra and being in charge all the time, but in actuality, in the real world, it's not anything like that. The conductor's responsibility is to basically make sure that we're all on the same page, because when you have 100 people in a room, everyone's gonna have different ideas and different ways to do things. And what we wanna do is have a unified presentation, and that's the conductor's job. So sometimes they get angry and they get worked up, but it's because they're so passionate about their vision and they're trying to bring us along with them. You know, it's sometimes it could be like pulling teeth, but other times it's glorious.
I have to ask this before we finish up here. There's an interesting technological aspect, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, with Side by Side. The show is going to be live streamed. Gabrielle, family back at home, they're going to be watching this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what have you told them about what to expect? And I mean, have they seen you before like this? Have you ever done a show like this where it was live streamed? Have you ever seen? Have you ever been in a show where it was live streamed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my life after here will be great, because I would like to continue the studios, and for me the side by side will be very, very great experience, and I would like to just continue.
Okay. All right. Darren, just real briefly, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, do you see the concert live stream as the future for classical musicians? Is this the way we're just going?
Yeah, it's one future for sure. I think it's great if it could be paired with the live experience as well, because there's a lot that you gain from being in a live room. But being able to reach the far corners of wherever you have internet is amazing. And if we can expose people that way and then bring them into a concert hall, that's the best way to do it. But having live streaming this side by side is going to be a really great opportunity to show a lot of students who don't have a lot of access to great orchestras what's possible in their musicianship.
And, you know, you talk about accessibility, you know, so this allows more people to listen and hear it and see it if they don't get the chance to go to a show. But what do you think it's going to do for getting people to want to get into it? Because it's still an expensive thing to do.
It is. I mean, the cost threshold is quite high for classical music, and that's something that we need to address in the future as well. But the way that New World does these live streams and the wall cast that we have on the side of the building, it's quite a dynamic experience, and it really makes the orchestra concert exciting. And I think that's what draws people into New World and to come see live shows with a ticket in hand. Yeah.
Well, again, that is the side-by-side concert. It's this weekend. Again, it features international connections through technology. The concert will be live streamed and broadcast in the Soundscape Park. And again, I've been talking with Brianna Garcon. She's from the Dillard School for the Arts in Fort Lauderdale. Also, Gabrielle Isquisachi. Did I get that right? Perfect. All right. A bassoonist from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And Canadian Darren Hicks, also a bassoonist in his third year as a fellow at the New World Symphony. Gabrielle, Brianna, Darren, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank
so
you
much.
Very much.
And have a one. You know, how do they say? Do they say break a leg? How do they say it?
You can say break a leg, toy, toy, toy.
Toy, toy. I like that one even better. Toy, yeah. Toy, toy. All right. Well, that's the program for today. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you soon.